This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Saudi Arabia's King Salman told U.S. President Donald Trump in a phone call Sunday that the kingdom was eager to achieve a fair and permanent solution to the Palestinian issue, which he said was the main starting point of the kingdom's proposed Arab Peace Initiative. The Arab Peace Initiative was drawn up by the Saudi Arabia government in 2002, in which Arab nations offered Israel normalized ties in return for a statehood deal with the Palestinians and full Israeli withdrawal from the territory captured in 1967. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is talking tough ahead of crucial rounds of post-Brexit trade talks with the European Union. He says Britain is prepared to walk away and insist a no-deal exit would be a good outcome for the UK. With talks deadlocked, Johnson says an agreement will only be possible if EU negotiators were prepared to rethink their current positions. The EU, in turn, accuses Britain of failing to take the negotiations seriously. EU and UK negotiators are meeting in London Tuesday for the eighth round of talks since Britain left the now 27-nation bloc on January 31st. The two sides are seeking a new deal on trade, security, and other issues. The third typhoon in as many weeks has brought more rain and wind to South Korea after damaged buildings caused blackouts in nearly 500,000 homes and injured 20 people in southern Japan's islands. Traffic was still paralyzed in southern Japan after the typhoon passed. Bullet trains were suspended and most domestic flights in and out of southwestern Japanese airports were canceled Monday. Hanshin has moved on shore in the southern South Korean city of Ulsan by mid-morning, and forecasters warned of very heavy rain and very strong winds. This is VOA News. India has now passed Brazil for the highest number of COVID infections worldwide. I should say the second highest. It became the second worst hit country on a day when the urban metro trains partially resumed service in the capital, New Delhi, and other states. More than 90,000 cases have been added to India's caseload in the past 24 hours. India is now only behind the United States, which has more than 6 million cases. India's health ministry Monday also reported more than 1,000 deaths for more a total of more than 71,000. India has been recording the world's largest daily coronavirus caseload for almost a month, even as the government pushes to open businesses to revive a contracting economy. Australia announced on Monday it had struck supply and production agreements with pharmaceutical companies worth $1.7 billion over two potential COVID-19 vaccines. Under the agreement, Britain's University of Oxford, in collaboration with AstraZeneca and Australia's University of Queensland, working with CSL, will provide more than 84.8 million vaccine doses for Australia's population of 26 million, almost entirely manufactured in the Australian city of Melbourne. Julian Assange's legal battle to avoid extradition to the United States, where he faces criminal charges over the activities of his WikiLeaks website, continues in a London court this Monday after months of hiatus caused by the coronavirus lockdown. The U.S. authorities accused the Australian-born 49-year-old Assange of conspiring to hack government computers and violating an espionage law in connection with the colossal release of confidential diplomatic cables by WikiLeaks in 2010 and 11. Assange is seen by his admirers around the world as a champion of free speech and investigative journalism who exposed abuses of power and other questionable practices by arms of the U.S. government, boldly challenging the global superpower. His critics in Washington and other Western capitals say that by publishing unredacted documents, he recklessly endangered the lives of people in Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan who had assisted Western powers in some way or another. Assange denies accusations by American investigators that WikiLeaks obtained the documents from Russian hackers. Feminist groups and family members of missing persons continue to occupy the offices of the National Human Rights Commission on Sunday as they called on governments in Mexico to take more action to combat gender-based violence and locate missing persons. The building was initially occupied by missing persons family members and advocates Thursday and Friday. Feminist groups joined that protest. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, September 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. West African leaders are meeting today, Monday, to consider a number of burning issues to the region.
It's a summit that will talk about the response to COVID-19 in Africa, and then the Mali issue will also come up.
We'll get analysis about U.S. sanctions on some ICC officials. Malawi's president announces measures to spark his country's economy. The WHO says it is unlikely that a safe, effective vaccine against COVID-19 will be available before the middle of next year. And Zambia's government refutes allegations it wants to arrest the main opposition leader.
We don't see any threats that can excite us to get locked up or things like that. What we need is a process, such as an inquiry, for example, where all those that have got facts about what transpired can come and give an account. And then premised on that, decisions can be made.
And we'll tell you why some Christians in Cameroon are abandoning their church. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, are meeting today, Monday, in the Nigerian capital, Niamey. This will be the first face-to-face meeting since the onset of COVID-19 restrictions 6 months ago. At the conclusion of their last virtual summit on August 20th, the leaders told the military junta in Mali that they wanted a one-year transition to democratic rule. Monday's summit also comes as the weekend meeting between the junta and the leaders of the M5 protest movement got off to a rocky start. The military and the M5 want a transition process of 18 months, but they have yet to agree on who should head the transition period. Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
It's a summit that will talk about the response to COVID-19 in Africa. You know, Nigerian president was made the champion of COVID response in Africa.
So I understand that this summit is going to be the first face-to-face summit since the COVID-19. Why that?
You know that most countries in the region have started opening up. For instance, Nigeria opened to international air traffic on September 5th. And most other countries in the region are also opening up. And this summit specifically will take a special report on the response to COVID-19 in the region. You know, the Nigerian president at a special summit, an extraordinary summit held in April, was made a champion of the COVID-19 response in the sub-region. So it's going to give a report to the summit. And then the summit will also look at issues of the ECOWAS single currency, which has been on the table for quite a while. President Julius Maada Bio of Sierra Leone is going to present a report on that. There will also be a report on Economic Monetary Union of West Africa. That is represented by President Alassane Ouattara of Cote d'Ivoire. And then the Mali issue will also come up. The president of the ECOWAS Commission, Jean-Claude Kassigrou, will present a report on the activities of the body so far on Mali.
On the issue of Mali, it seems to mean that the military junta will not be able to meet ECOWAS's demand to present some transition program by the 7th of September.
Well, we do not know yet until that meeting comes. Maybe there will be a brief from the ECOWAS Special Envoy to Mali. Maybe there will be a briefing, and that's when the body of head of state and government can take a decision.
So you mentioned that international flights have started to arrive in Nigeria. Does this mean that COVID-19 is behind Nigeria?
Not exactly, because the Presidential Task Force of COVID-19 in its briefing on Thursday still warned that the worst was not over. We are not actually out of the woods, but Nigeria has decided to balance lives and livelihoods. Keep safe, but livelihoods should not suffer. If you continue to close your borders, airspace, people can come in, people can travel, livelihood will be adversely affected.
Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. The Trump administration last week announced sanctions on International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor and Gambian-born Fatou Bensouda and the court's head of jurisdiction, Pakiso Muchochoko, originally from Lesotho. Umar Ba, an international relations expert and author of States of Justice, talks to Ricky Stryak about what the U.S. sanctions mean for the ICC and the significance of going after two of the court's African officials.
Most of the people who've been watching the ICC closely, the relation that the court has with the United States, especially since at the beginning of the Trump administration, are not really surprised about what happened. Now, this is an extreme measure. No one has gone this far ever against the ICC. Even previous administrations were also very critical and adversarial towards the court. It's not totally surprising, given that all the Trump administration has been saying, and the Bolton speech, I think it was, 2 years ago, when he said that the ICC is dead to us, and Pompeo himself had made a speech a few months ago, which had announced that they would be taking these actions towards the ICC.
What does this mean for the ICC's operations, and does this further delegitimize the U.S. on an international stage when it comes to the idea of international justice?
For the U.S., this is just one step further toward retreating from these international organizations and these global governance. For the ICC, this has also the potential of limiting its reach, its work, and this could actually have a very serious effect on the ICC because, again, anyone who has dealings with these two individuals run the risk of being accused by the U.S. government of material assistance toward them and could themselves be sanctioned by the U.S. government. So this is definitely a very serious issue for the ICE. Now, that will also depend on how other states will respond to this, especially EU member states that are part of the ICE.
What do you think there is to say, if anything, about the fact that the two individuals they have targeted are Africans?
Yes, of course. The fact that the Trump administration has chosen two individuals that they targeted for these sanctions. One is Bensouda, who is from the Gambia, and one of her top aides, who is from Lesotho. Now, the interesting thing is that even if the Trump administration was only concerned with the Office of the Prosecutor, there are five top individuals in there. There's Bensouda, who is chief prosecutor, but her deputy prosecutor is a gentleman from Canada. And there are three top aides within her office. The fact is that two people were singled out, both from Africa, both black Africans, says a lot about what's the context of this. Because the other ones, Canadian, Italian, and Belgian, they're citizens of states that are EU members, they are NATO allies, and of course the Trump administration didn't want to go against these individuals, so they would pick the two targets that they do believe do not have a strong international support behind them.
That was Umar Ba, author of States of Justice. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Atlanta. Zambia's Interior Affairs Minister says President Edgar Lungu is not interested in arresting and locking up his political opponents to prevent them from contesting the 2021 presidential election. Stephen Kampiongo says the ruling Patriotic Front Party will defeat the leading opposition party without any difficulties. Last week, Hakainde Hichilema, leader of the main opposition United Party for National Development, the UPND, said President Lungu's government wanted to arrest him and later kill him to deprive him from participating in the 2021 election. Edith Nawakwe, former finance minister in the previous government, had alleged that Mr. Hichilema, as chairman of the Zambia Privatization Agency negotiating team, sold government enterprises that were slated for privatization to himself. Interior Affairs Minister Kampiongo accuses Hichilema of trafficking in lying against the government.
You may wish to know that this debate
was generated by Mr. Akinde himself, because on several platforms where people have engaged him to seek for answers as to why he is such a rich man in Zambia, so he could share with the rest of the Zambian people and the entire world, just like many others, Aliko Dangote is able to give you a background of where he's coming from, where he is. Now, he has tried several times to dodge the actual questions, specifically to respond to how he generated wealth.
Mr. Minister, we spoke with the spokesperson for UPND. He claims that the finance, or the former finance minister, Ms. Nawakwe, was in charge, and that Mr. Hichilema was not.
Madam Nawakwe was minister responsible for finance, and she was not responsible. They had engaged Mr. Akinde Hichilema as a negotiator, meaning he had to negotiate with possible buyers of these assets. What is alleged to have done in this case is that he knew that he had interest. These assets were estimated to cost about $26 million. Okay? They were bidders who bidded to try and buy those assets. $20.1 million. There was a bidder who was about 18, and another one at 10, and the other bid was 5.2, somewhere like that, 5 something million dollars. Now, it so happened that Mr. Hichilema and his team settled for this low bid, which they came to convince Edith Nawakwe that that bid was the most viable because the buyers were going to improve the facilities. Now, it didn't occur to Edith Nawakwe when she tried to argue, according to what she's saying, when she tried to argue with them to say, no, this is too low. What are we going to gain as government? That's when they explained that, no, the investment that will come into the property is much more better than the one who is offering $21 million, because these want to come and clean the existing facilities, clean the carpets and beds and all that kind of thing. That's the impression they gave you. Now, the question which has arisen is that later on, as we speak now, Mr. Hichilema is one of the directors without declaring interest at that point to say he was interested in this, in the same assets.
UPND youth are saying that they will not allow the police to arrest their leader in any manner.
We are not preoccupied with getting him arrested. We would want to see a process, like I'm saying, that will create a platform for all those who have got facts about what transpired during the privatization program to have chance to give an account. Now, as to whether the UPND are saying they will not allow, no one is above the law.
Stephen Kampiongo, Zambia's Interior Affairs Minister, he was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, September 7th. Malawi's President, Lazarus Chakwera, has announced plans to pull the country out of poverty, which he blamed on past governments. Chakwera proposed a series of reforms in his first State of the Nation address since being elected in June. Lamech Masina reports from Blantyre.
In his address to Parliament Friday, which ran more than an hour, President Lazarus Chakwera dismissed the notion that Malawi is a poor country.
You may have heard it said that Malawi is a poor country, but we must reject this lie. Surely, my country, with $85 million in gold exported to the Middle East every year, is not poor. My country, with a freshwater lake and multiple rivers capable of generating $100 million a year in revenue, is not poor.
Chakwera said the poverty which Malawi is renowned, however, is man-made.
Ours is a country stripped of its God-given wealth and potential by syndicates of people in the public sector who exploit decades of bad government policies and practices to enrich themselves at the expense of Malawians. In short, the poverty of our people is man-made, which means it can and must be unmade.
President Chakwera announced several reforms in various sectors, including three arms of government, the executive, judiciary, and legislature.
To reform the executive, we have embarked on a full-scale orientation of the public sector to the pillars of my Super High Five agenda: servant leadership, uniting Malawi, prospering together, ending corruption, and the rule of law. This will happen across the public sector over the next year.
In the agriculture sector, a lifeline in Malawi's economy, Chakwera announced the start of an affordable inputs program in which 4.3 million smallholder farmers will receive subsidized seeds and fertilizers. He said this will tremendously improve the level of productivity in the sector, which currently contributes 30% of the country's gross domestic product. Sherif Kaisi is a political science lecturer at Blantyre International University. He says it's time for President Chakwera to walk the talk.
If he's to live by his words, it means now it's time for work. No more promises. Malawians wants to see 1 million jobs, want to see universal subsidy of fertilizer, want to see trimming down of the costs of the passport. Those things which were already promised, and now they just live on those promises.
Bichani Cheleni, an economics lecturer at the University of Malawi, said Chakwera's speech was inspiring.
Well, the speech is it's giving some hope in the sense that the president has been able to explain to us why the economy is behaving as it is behaving now and what are the solutions. And because there are solutions, one would say that, yes, indeed, I think there's some hope that can come on the way.
Cheleni says eyes are now on Chakwera's national budget, which his finance minister is expected to deliver during the sitting of parliament that begins Monday. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The World Health Organization says it is unlikely that a safe, effective vaccine against COVID-19 will be available for widespread use before the middle of next year. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Health officials are urging people to lower their expectations. They say the development of a safe, efficacious vaccine takes time and cannot be rushed. As it is, the World Health Organization reports remarkable progress is being made toward this end. It notes at least 6 to 9 candidate vaccines have begun phase 3 clinical trials. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris says many thousands of people participate in these carefully crafted trials. She says a vaccine must be proven to be safe and seen to provide protection against the coronavirus in at least 50% of subjects before it can be approved for public use. She says the safety of the vaccine has to be monitored at all stages of the research, making this a lengthy process.
The good news is the manufacturers are already putting bets on which one's likely to be the vaccine, and they're already working out how they can scale up production of vaccines once we know which ones are the ones we will roll out. But in terms of realistic timelines, we're really not expecting to see widespread vaccination until the middle of next year.
Harris tells VOA that WHO does not tell governments when a vaccine should be made available for emergency or general use. She says that is a decision for countries to make for themselves. However, she cautions against raising false hopes about the prospect of an imminent vaccine that will vanquish the pandemic.
What we've been saying over and over is nobody should be sitting there waiting for the magic bullet, thinking that the vaccine is going to solve all this or that there'll be a wonder drug. What we have to do now is do the things we know suppress this virus. And those are the basics, the hand washing, the social distancing that we're doing, the mask wearing.
She says WHO believes all nations must work together in the search for a vaccine. She says sharing and comparing data is important and will result in a vaccine that protects everybody. Harris calls this a global public good. She says a vaccine not only is essential, but must be provided in all parts of the world, adding that unless everybody is protected, nobody is protected. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Some Christians in Cameroon are abandoning their church because they say their pastor is preaching that COVID-19 does not exist. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Song, When God Speaks, blasts through loudspeakers at Winners Chapel, a popular church in the Fuda neighborhood in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. The song, by the Nigerian gospel singer Frank Okochukwu Edwards, is played to welcome 23 new members. Among them is 37-year-old Annabella Tabot. Tabot says she left the Tabernacles of Freedom's ministries because her pastor deceived them, saying that COVID-19 did not exist. Tabot says the pastor asked her 60-year-old husband not to go to the hospital and was instead praying for healing from evil spirits.
His health condition kept on deteriorating and he finally died. Luckily, the government came in and isolated him, and the other family members were not contaminated.
In August, Cameroon's government closed Tabernacles of Freedom's ministries for preaching that COVID-19 is a hoax. Many of its 300 members defied government orders and kept worshiping in front of the closed church. Tabot said more than 100 members left the church when her sick husband died shortly after he was suspected of having COVID-19 and forced to go to the hospital by the government. The Association of Pentecostal Churches in Yaoundé reported that at least 270 Christians left from six churches that preached against the existence of COVID-19. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Pomale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in East Africa, where Tanzanian champions Simba have named Barbara Gonzalez as chief executive officer, becoming the first ever female CEO in the country's top flight league. Gonzalez will fill the position left vacant by South African Senzo Mbatha, who left his position for arch rivals Young Africans in a sensational move last month. The Confederation of African Football has expressed shock and dismay over the disappearance of a number of old trophies from the Egyptian Football Association, including an original African Cup of Nations. On Friday, the Egyptian Football Association announced that it had discovered the disappearance of some old trophies from its stores, affirming that it will investigate to locate them. The original African Cup of Nations trophies that the Pharaohs won in 2006, 2008, and 2010 are among the missing trophies. Staying with football news, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa have successfully retained the South African Premier Soccer League title, winning it for the 10th time in the club's history. The Brazilians, as they are popularly known, defeated Black Leapers 3-0 on Saturday to ensure their maximum points tally, thanks to a sensational hat-trick from Leboang Mbowe. Coach Pitso Mosimane was full of praises for his boys.
We had a lot of pressure outside and internal in the club, to be honest. People doubting me, but God is there for me. These boys made it possible. A lot of people didn't believe in the team. A lot of people didn't believe in me.
And on to athletics, where Kenya's Purity Jepchichir on Saturday broke the women's only world half marathon record after emerging victorious in the 2020 Prague half marathon in Czech Republic, clocking 1 hour, 5 minutes and 34 seconds to smash previous record of 1 hour, 6 minutes and 11 seconds set by Netsanet Gutera of Ethiopia at the World Half Marathon Championships in 2018.
I thank my God for the energy that he has given me. I'm so happy, I'm proud. I was thinking maybe I could have run 64.50s, but yes, I'm satisfied. It's difficult to run a lot. Yeah, if I could have had pacemakers, I could have run 64.
In the men's category, another Kenyan, Kibuot Kandia, won the men's title after clocking 38 minutes and 37 seconds.
My wish is to run again when this pandemic is over, and it will be our pleasure to continue competing in the road races.
And finally, African representatives to the 2021 World Men's Handball Championship now know their opponents following the draw held at the weekend. The tournament will consist of 32 teams and is set to take place in Egypt next year, starting from the 14th to the 31st of January. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, September 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington. Hope